by Lucky Station.
With SRN News, I'm Val Dior. In its latest advisory, the National Hurricane Center said a significant phase of intensification of Tropical Storm Florence is expected this evening, and the storm could grow to a Cat 4 hurricane by midweek. But its path is still unclear, though North Carolina has issued a state of emergency, and the U.S. Navy is making preparations to move its ships off of the East Coast. Airlines have already delayed or canceled several flights in the Southeast. A giant trash collection device has left San Francisco to go pick up plastic litter floating in the Pacific Ocean between California and Hawaii. The 2,000-foot-long floating boom designed to trap plastic is being towed toward the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. That's an island of trash twice the size of Texas. Secretary of Defense General Mad Dog Mattis celebrating a birthday today. Turned 68, and Naomi Osaka wins the U.S. Open title after Serena Williams was penalized a game in the final. She called the chair ump a thief. This is SRN News.
Larry Elder says the Democrats are full of ideas.
The caller was talking about Democrats not having any ideas. They got plenty of ideas. And when they advance an idea, you have to ask yourself three simple things. How much is it going to cost? Who's going to pay? And will it in fact work? And usually the whole idea falls apart under that very simple analysis.
The Larry Elder Show. Afternoons at 5 on AM 1280. The Patriot. Intelligent radio.
The following program was pre-recorded, and the views expressed do not necessarily represent those of this station or its management.
We don't need no education. We don't need no thought control.
Welcome to Education Nation, where we tackle the biggest issues in American education. School is now in session. Here are your hosts, Headmaster Rebecca Hagstrom and co-host Mark Durkin.
Well, good evening, and thank you so much for joining us here on Education Nation. I am Headmaster and host Rebecca Hagstrom, and it's a privilege to join you every Saturday evening here on AM 1280 The Patriot. And of course, I'm joined in studio once again by producer of Education Nation and my co-host, Mark Durkin.
Well, hello again, Rebecca.
Good afternoon, I should say to you.
It all runs together when the school year starts, doesn't it?
It sure does. Yes. We are 2 weeks in, and tell you, it's amazing how quickly it becomes routine.
And the sweatshirts are out now. I wore one earlier this week just with the weather getting nice and cool. I'm liking this.
Yeah, I know. I think most Minnesotans are. Well, listen, we are going to jump right in here because we have a wonderful guest that we always enjoy having on our show. But before we introduce her, I just want to introduce our topic. On July 25th, the Minnesota Supreme Court issued a ruling with the potential to transform K-12 education in the Twin Cities for decades to come. The court decided that Cruz Guzman versus the state of Minnesota, a case in which plaintiffs seek court-ordered metro-wide racial balancing in public schools in the Twin Cities region can go forward.
And that's right. The court's decision of 4-2 to overturn a 2017 dismissal of the case, which had previously ruled that whether students of color are getting an adequate education is a question for the legislature, not the courts. In dissenting, Justice Barry Anderson, while acknowledging the appalling performance of Minneapolis and St. Paul public schools, he stated, quote, "The courts should not intervene where the legislature and the governor have failed. As attractive as that option might seem, ultimately we lack authority to address what is fundamentally a political question," end of quote. Mm-hmm. And speaking for the majority opinion in this case, Justice Natalie Hudson had stated, quote, "We will not shy away from our proper role to provide remedies for violations of fundamental rights merely because education is a complex area," end of quote. Now, we can all agree that we must come together and devote our energy in providing an education that works for all Minnesota children. However, research and more than 40 years of experience demonstrate that though extremely costly, neither the race-based busing nor learning gap programs are likely to improve minority performance.
Mm-hmm. And even if they were, do we want legislation coming from the bench?
Not at all.
No, we don't. And once again, that's what we're seeing potentially happening in this case. Well, joining us by telephone to bring clarity to this important ruling is Catherine Kirsten. Catherine is a writer, an attorney, a senior policy fellow, and founding director at the Center of the American Experiment, having also served as its chair from 1996 to 1998. She's also served as a Metro columnist for the Star Tribune from 2005 to 2008, and before that was an opinion columnist for the paper for 17 years. She's been a guest many times on Education Nation and is a name that is recognized by the AM 1280 Patriot audience. Catherine, thanks again for joining us this evening.
Well, it's my pleasure.
Glad to have you on. Before we begin to discuss the ramifications of the Cruz Guzman case, it's important to understand that Minnesota policymakers have assumed for more than 40 years that racial balance in schools is the key to improving minority performance. Can you share with our listeners what initial steps were taken actually back in 1973 and 95 and what that mandatory busing did?
Yes, there was actually, believe it or not, a court-ordered busing in Minneapolis starting in 1974. Mm-hmm. Very controversial decision. But that went on for 20 years. And toward the end, it was not because of the court order anymore, but because the state had adopted so-called integration rules that the Minneapolis schools were trying to conform to. And actually, those Minneapolis schools were perfectly racially balanced for some time. Unfortunately, this did not result in improved performance by black students in Minneapolis. In fact, the last few years of busing saw actual declines in reading and math scores by the black students there. But in 1995, this may be what you're referring to, Sharon Sales Belton, who was mayor of Minneapolis at the time and an African-American, pushed very hard for and was successful in getting an end to race-based busing in Minneapolis. She said, we are busing our black students every day the distance to the moon and back. This is not a good use of money. It would be much wiser, since this has torn apart neighborhoods, makes it much harder for parents to get to their kids' schools that are farther away, and maybe they've got kids at several schools. She said it would be much better off devoting this funding and a focus of attention to improving the schools rather than thinking that, you know, if black kids sit next to white kids, this somehow this is going to help them to learn better, would be the answer.
Yeah. Interesting that it was Mayor Belton, that Mayor Sales Belton, that understood that and made that change.
Well, she joined a number of black mayors across the nation at that time. Mayor Wellington Webb in Denver, Seattle, Cleveland, all saying the same thing. Stop this, and let's focus on kids, not on skin color.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, so true. And that was back in 1995. And you've kind of touched on the fact that other cities had been trying this around the nation as well. What kind of impact did that have around the country in all these different American cities?
Well, if you're a person of a certain age, you remember when race-based busing was extremely widespread, and for decades, but it failed everywhere in any city or metro area of any meaningful size to have any kind of significant effect on the so-called racial learning gap. It cost, you know, billions of dollars. Everybody, I think many people remember Kansas City, for example, where every school in the city was turned into a fabulously expensive magnet school trying to draw white kids in because, you know, the balance of skin colors was considered important. Mm-hmm. And it failed so miserably that essentially the Kansas City schools no longer were able to operate under their own control. And they had to be moved to the state because they failed so miserably. And this was true across the nation, that this notion of busing kids was simply a huge and very costly failure.
And heartbreaking for the kids. You know, you imagine how many children were affected by this. And, you know, I say often on this show, kids get one shot at an education.
Right.
And so often policymakers look at things from such a big picture viewpoint. They want to try this. They want to try that. They forget that these are kids, and you really need to be thinking through and researching and testing things before you try them on these
Establish
kids.
Establish some facts first.
And determine whether it really is going to be workable.
It's just so true. What they never look at is, how are children taught?
Right.
It's all about putting them next to a person with another skin color, never what's actually happening
in the classroom.
School in terms of effective classroom instruction.
Right. And that's really where it comes down to.
Think of the stress it puts on the kids, too. I mean, if they're being bused to a further distance, they're having to get up earlier in the morning. That's less time they're spending with their family.
Yeah.
It just snowballs.
Absolutely.
It absolutely does, yeah. Well, in 1995, Minnesota State Board of Education sought to win approval for a metro-wide desegregation plan under the sponsorship of then-state legislator Myron Orfeld. What were some of the key components of Orfeld's plan, and what were some of the crucial flaws that prohibited this busing plan from gaining traction? So even though they knew it was failing, they're still going to try to make it happen again.
Yeah.
Yes, because it's an ideology that's not evidence-based. So what Myron Orfeld wanted and wants today in this current case, actually, where he's filed an amicus brief, is metro-wide race-based busing for the entire Twin Cities. The idea, you know, from my perspective, is to take something that has failed everywhere it's been tried and expand it.
Right.
And in fact, Dan Schulman, who is the attorney who brought this Guzman case, the one that, you know, you were discussing initially, had the New York Times just the last couple of weeks that he wants a 7-county race-based busing remedy in this case. And he says that means there will be no white flight because where will they go?
Oh, my goodness.
Yep.
Wow. What a controlling
insult to parents of all races.
Yes. Yes. It is an insult to parents of all races. Absolutely.
Well, so the idea back then was to put this into place. The State Board of Education unanimously endorsed it. And this would have required busing kids from Belle Plaine, Jordan, et cetera, on the fringes of the metro area to achieve racial balance in particular Minneapolis and St. Paul schools, certainly in all the 7-county metro area schools.
You mentioned Dan Schulman there, Catherine, who's representing the plaintiffs in this Cruz Guzman case. He had filed a lawsuit years ago to go the same objective, and that produced the court case NAACP versus the state of Minnesota, which was settled in 2000 with the creation of the Choice is Yours program. What school options did this program allow for Minneapolis students? I mean, how did these students perform academically in their new school settings, and did their performance really stack up against low-income Minneapolis students that stayed in the city schools?
Right. Well, that was the settlement. The low-income Minneapolis kids at state expense were given the option to transfer to, I think it was 8 suburban school districts if the space was available, and thousands of them took advantage of that opportunity. It was very disappointing, though, in terms of increased academic achievements. And in fact, I think it was twice, maybe 3 times, that the scores were actually assessed, and the students who had left were compared to a controlled group in Minneapolis. And the first time there was found to be a very, very slight improvement. The second time there was found to be a rather significant decline or difference, a negative difference in the performance of the kids who had been bused. Now, the parents uniformly said they really thought this was a great idea. That is, the parents who participated, but not many kids stayed for more than just a short period because it was just such a long bus
distance.
Ride.
Exactly.
And they wanted to be with their friends.
Right,
you
their
know,
neighborhood friends.
So the program is actually defunct at this point. It did have an expiration date that was extended once, I think, but, you know, nobody is saying that this was any kind of great success at all. And, of course, there's so many more options now with charters, and we continue to have open enrollment in a very unusual way in Minnesota.
Right,
Yeah. You're listening to Education Nation here on AM 1280 The Patriot. Tonight we're speaking with Catherine Kirsten. She's helping us understand Minnesota's history of racial balancing over the last 40 years, what may be in store for Twin Cities schools on the racial equity front in light of the state Supreme Court's affirmative ruling. We'll get to these specifics in just a few moments. But first, at the turn of the decade, it was exceedingly clear that busing students for integration was failing everywhere. But, you know, Eden Prairie wanted to give this a try next. And by this time, there was a change in the approach. And why is that? Well, right. In 2007, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that busing students for racial balance was unconstitutional. And as a result, we mentioned Myron Orfield. Again, he created a new desegregation plan that would bus elementary students to schools, some across town from their homes, on the basis of income now, not race. At the time, the officials insisted that this plan would produce economic diversity that would improve the academic achievement of low-income minority children. Well, in 2013, the Minnesota Campaign for Achievement Now, or otherwise known as MNCAN, school and district report cards recognized 5 Eden Prairie schools as top-performing public schools for Latino and Asian student performance. And despite these gains, MNCAN had reported that achievement gaps in the Eden Prairie Public School District between white and black students at the secondary level remained well above state averages. So listening to this assessment, Catherine, is it safe to draw the conclusion, I mean, really, that such differences have more to do often with radically different social and familial environments than with school policies?
Yes, that is absolutely right. But let me just say first that what happened in 2007 with the Supreme Court is that busing students for racial balance alone, rather than because the government had deliberately and in a discriminatory way separated kids on the basis of race, as was done in the old South. If that were done today, that would, you can't say black kids go here, white kids go there. But of course that has essentially disappeared, that phenomenon. And so many places, many school districts had tried this busing just for so-called diversity or racial balance. That's what the Supreme Court said is not allowed. And that's the reason that Dan Shulman is using the state courts in Minnesota, not the federal courts, because you can't possibly do what he wants to do in the federal courts today. So, yes, back to Eden Prairie. It's absolutely clear, and there's abundant social science research, that socioeconomic and familial risk factors are the cause of the racial learning gap that we see. Mm-hmm. We know that there is a very large gap between the black and white and Asian out-of-wedlock birth rates, for example, in Minnesota and across the nation. We know that that black kids on average who take, say, the Peabody vocabulary test at the age of 5 perform at more than a full standard deviation below white 5-year-olds. They come to school on average with deficits that schools need to know how to improve on.
And interesting, I don't want to get down a rabbit trail here, but the early childhood programs that they have done with, I think it's Head Start programs, they have not demonstrated success in closing that gap, which I find is interesting as well.
No.
So again, it comes down to the familial and the social environments, not the school program that they're in.
Right. Now, there are school programs that can help, and we can talk about those if we have time, and some of these high expectations, beat the odds charter schools, for example.
Right.
It's very impressive what kids from low-income backgrounds can do. But you've got to really know what you're doing.
Right.
It's a big project.
Yeah, and I should correct the way I said that. It's what is being done in the school in terms of what is the content, how is it being taught. Those are the things that can really make a difference. I know Hope Academy, which is a private school, not charter, down in downtown Minneapolis, that works with low-income children, a lot of minority students, has great success with their kids.
Good example.
Yeah. So it can be done. It's just that some of the money that we're pouring into these state programs are not necessarily working.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, in the years leading up to the Cruz Guzman case, the state of Minnesota was on the cusp of another lawsuit, which would threaten both the quality of our public schools and our cherished tradition of school choice. And the Cruz Guzman is described as an education adequacy lawsuit. Can you tell us a little bit more about what type of lawsuit the plaintiffs are trying to portray and how expensive things can get for the state of Minnesota in light of the state's Supreme Court ruling?
Yes, indeed. Yeah. So an education adequacy case is a case brought in state court for the reason I just described. Hmm. You cannot do this in federal court anymore. So the smart people who want to represent plaintiffs in these kinds of cases have looked at the state constitutions, and Minnesota is pretty typical. We have an education clause in our state constitution that says that the state will create a general and uniform system of education, thorough and efficient education. That's what, you know, it will provide. So these plaintiffs are looking at that very vague language, and they're claiming that they insert this notion of adequacy, which isn't in the Constitution, and they claim that low-income minority kids are not getting a so-called adequate education, which they say is guaranteed by the state constitution because of the racial learning gap, because of their overall lower academic performance. So in most education adequacy cases, plaintiffs have sought simply more money and tons and tons of more money. But what Dan Shulman is doing here, I'm sure that this will cost a lot of money. He is saying that the adequacy, that what we have in this state educationally, or that is in Minneapolis-St. Paul, is not an adequate education because of racial and socioeconomic imbalance.
Right.
So on that basis, he wants to bus kids for the color of their skin type reasons.
Right. And that's the part that just baffles me, because certainly everybody sees that the gap is not okay, and everybody wants to solve it. But I don't understand this constant movement towards thinking that if we just mix everybody perfectly well, that that's going to make the difference. And especially as you say that there's proven track records that that does not solve the problem.
Right.
We are going to have to keep going here. We've got so many more things we want to ask you about, and we're running out of time. Let's quickly go into this next question here. While Minnesota taxpayers are facing a potential fiscal disaster in light of Cruz Guzman, what can we expect when considering other victorious adequacy plaintiffs in states such as New Jersey and Colorado?
Well, New Jersey, they've had education adequacy litigation for over 40 years now, with massive sums that caused property taxes to be raised and almost created a revolt on the part of taxpayers. All this money going to very low income districts. The racial achievement gap essentially has not budged there, despite all of this. But the case that is most important for us is the only other case in the nation, which is like Shulman's case, where plaintiffs blamed a racial imbalance for inadequate education. That's the Sheff case in Connecticut. There, that's been going. It was filed in 1986. Think of that. And the courts are still controlling the schools in Hartford, Connecticut.
Wow.
They have spent over $3 billion on specialized magnet schools there for kids. And it's so perverse, the outcome after 30 years, that Black and Latino kids who really want to get into these schools, and some of them are being turned away. So that some of them, 40% of the seats are being left vacant because the state will only pay for them if they have 25%, at least 25% white and Asian students.
No.
So there are all these Black kids. This was brought on their behalf, right?
Right.
And they can't even get into the extremely expensive magnet schools created
supposedly to help them.
It's a total outrage.
Oh, that is heartbreaking. Absolutely heartbreaking.
That's really, I mean, if education adequacy litigation doesn't raise student achievement, I mean, why are courts continuing to rule for plaintiffs in these suits, do you think?
Well, I think that the primary reason is that plaintiffs have done such a good job in putting in people's minds that these schools are segregated. We all know segregation is bad, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, current schools. It is utterly false. Mm-hmm. The schools in Minneapolis and St. Paul are racially imbalanced, but segregation, Brown v. Board of Education mm-hmm. type segregation, requires deliberate, intentional government action to separate kids. So what we have here is fantastic school choice in mm-hmm. Minnesota. Mm-hmm. We have charter schools that Dan Shulman is going after that are 100% black. They are chosen by parents. Some are these high expectation, rigorous, beat the odds charter schools. The parents want their kids there.
Right.
Dan Shulman doesn't want them there because even though parents choose them, he says, nope, got to have a bunch of white kids in your class or you're not going to be adequately educated. So this could spell a huge, well, almost the end of choice as we know it in Minnesota if plaintiffs get what they want.
Mm-hmm.
And in light of the plaintiff's case here with Cruz Guzman, there are two central elements that are tied into learning gap-related plans that a court would likely adopt as a framework to determine whether Minnesota students are receiving an adequate or equitable education. What might those be, if you could describe those for us?
Well, I mean, I'm not quite sure what you mean by that, but they look at the plaintiffs want them to look at the learning gap between kids of different races and to say that because there's a learning gap, they are not getting an adequate education. And if, number one, they had more money, or in the case of Dan Shulman's case, if they had racial balance in the classrooms, then the kids would, by definition, be getting an adequate education. But of course, they don't consider that the real reasons for these learning gaps sure. are these socioeconomic family risk factors that we discussed earlier. And it's very hard for schools to do what we'd all like to have done about that.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the things that I want to focus on is to give you the opportunity to tell us what, from your research, you've done a lot of research on this topic over the years, Catherine. What are the most effective ways to improve poor minority children's learning?
Well, I think, number one, we need to expand school choice, not mm-hmm. constrict it the way that Dan Shulman wants to do. I think the way kids are taught in the high-performing, heavily minority charter schools that I have visited is so different from what's done in the ordinary public school. Mm-hmm. For example, when I visited several years ago Harvest Prep mm-hmm. School, which is run by Eric Mahmoud in Minneapolis, they are so intentional. They have 100-minute blocks mm-hmm. of reading and math instruction time. They are so focused on what many educators would dismiss as drill and kill work, say in mm-hmm. the early years in math. Those kids, when I visited, knew their math facts backwards and forwards. So it was all automatic for them. And as they went into more advanced mathematics, they were able to, they weren't hung up on facts they couldn't remember. Mm-hmm. And in reading, when they entered school, I mean, at five, the folks there already knew exactly where they were in terms of phonemic awareness, mm-hmm. learning how to read. They tested them every week. They found out exactly where they needed help. It's that kind of intentional instruction, and there's a focus on order and civility in the classroom, mm-hmm. high expectations for kids, alternative teacher certification, too. Mm-hmm. You don't have to jump through all the hoops that you have to otherwise.
Right.
I mean, it would be a wonderful, wonderful change.
Mm-hmm.
Those kinds of targeted interventions and common sense changes are what we need.
Absolutely.
We have about 20 seconds here, real quick, Catherine. What counsel would you give to parents that are really concerned about their kids potentially being bussed out of their chosen district?
Well, I think it's important that the public understand the risks here because hardly anybody knows that this is on the horizon. The Supreme Court, you know, may eventually make the final decision, the Minnesota Supreme Court, but they'll do it in a political atmosphere, right? If people know and object and write letters to the editor and speak to their legislators, et cetera, I think that could make a real difference in the outcome of the case.
Absolutely. Catherine, you are always a wealth of knowledge. Thank you so much for joining us again here. And thank you to our listeners, and we will see you again next Saturday on Education Nation.